Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello and welcome. Thank you to our founder, Brian Brown, whose voice we hear every week with great pleasure. I'm Susan McCabe, host of Real Talk here on Voice of Vachon. And in our democratic process on the Brown Briefly, I get to introduce our panelists today, starting with Truman O'Brien, God's co-pilot and zoologist at KVSH Studios. Welcome, Truman. How's your Tuesday?
Well, it's been going great. This morning we did, our show was on women's suffrage. Since we missed it last week, we kind of blew the timing. It was exactly a week ago today, 100 years ago, a week ago today. And Molly and I somehow missed that. And so we said, all right, we're going to make up for it today. We had about 8 hours worth of music that we could have played.
So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, thanks for getting to it.
One of the, I have to tell you real quick, one of the funnest albums was an album called Songs of Women's Suffrage, and it was by a woman named Elizabeth Knight. If you get a chance, look that up, because it's all music from that era, and it's just a hoot. Anyway, really fun.
From the suffragettes era?
Yeah. Wow. Really interesting. Yeah, Elizabeth Knight is her name. Yeah, look it up. It's very fun. Very fun.
Okay. Also coming to us through Zoom is Lynn Kerrigan, Dixie debutante and consummate intellectual. Hello, Lynn. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm glad to see you all. I have to tell you my little check-in story today is that since Truman mentioned that Voice of Vachon is considering a Facebook live streaming of this show, perhaps others as well, I thought I would see what it would take to my morning routine to get up and actually try to make myself look halfway decent for this. And I went and I put on makeup and lipstick, and now I don't recognize myself.
Well, we do.
You look lovely.
You look very nice.
It looks fake. I look like a clown. I'm not used to it, which is a good thing.
No makeup. Yeah, right.
So good morning.
Happy managed to get here.
What, Kevin?
The new faces of Brown Briefly.
That was Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vachon's favorite and leading scribe. Kevin, I bet you're pretty busy right now.
Things are busy. You know, we have summer activities. We're getting a little boating time in. We're getting out on the bicycle. My routine is now write like 50 postcards to voters in Florida and Iowa. And the excuse to get away from writing postcards is to hop on the bicycle and ride up to town and drop them in the mailbox and then come back and start writing more postcards. So, yeah, it's a busy time, and we're looking forward to good results in November.
We need about a million more of you.
Yes, we do.
Well, you know, we're happy to have others jump on board. There's about 40 or 50 postcard writers on Vachon. So folks who want to be part of that movement, you're in good company.
Mm-hmm.
And are you... Susan, can I ask him a question?
Sure.
Can I ask Kevin a question? Are you identifying yourself on your postcard as being from out of state?
It's, I identify myself as Kevin, a volunteer.
Ah, very good.
Yeah, I've been writing postcards as well, and that's the protocol, essentially, that the folks who are doing this Get Out the Vote campaign request. So it makes it personal without making it revelatory, if you will, or without breaking any privacy dicta. Okay, missing from our panel today is Chauncey Gardner, sometimes known as Chet, sometimes known as Michael Shook. He had something else to do that I don't know how it could be, but was more important than Brown Briefly. And last but not least at all is historian and battle-weary guardian of the galaxy, our own Bruce. Welcome, Bruce. Oh, yeah. Hold him up.
It's a difficult week with the Republican convention going on. COVID beginning to spike again. You know, it's sort of a... It's hard to be the guardian of the galaxy when the galaxy is in such dire need. But we soldier on regardlessly, right?
We'll just keep you as Sisyphus. As long as you can hold up the world, we'll be happy.
Keep those wings waxed.
Exactly.
Well, while we're on the subject, has anyone watched any portion of the Republican convention? Lynn, you're nodding your head.
I watched a good deal of it last night. I felt like it was important to kind of hear what they had to say and how they were saying it. And, you know, much of what they have to say, you can't argue with. It's God and apple pie and, you know, it's all of that. And some of it, though, is so simplistic and glossing over all the other things that have come to pass, you know, that the few good things that are being said seem dwarfed to me, but I'm in the opposite camp. What about y'all?
Anybody else watch any of it?
I watch bits and pieces of it. It's a little hard to sort of
make stomach.
Well, it's the sort of misrepresentation of reality. Is a little bit hard to take, you know, sort of, you know, portraying the president as being sort of a, you know, a champion of the fight against COVID rather than the cause of the situation, you know, and the stridency, sort of the angry stridency that comes out is just appalling. I mean, it's just, you know, you get a sense of these are, for the most part, rich white people who see the world crumbling around them and will do anything to preserve it.
Yeah, I watched the first half hour and that was all I could handle. But I did notice that all the women were buxom and wearing close-fitting, and of course they were white, wearing close-fitting sheath dresses and Guilfoyle, Trump's girlfriend, somehow somebody put a quarter in her and she was so strident and so loud. It was scary, downright scary. And I believe I read somewhere that it appeared that Trump Jr. was high on cocaine when he gave his speech. So they must've been having a great party there. Kevin?
Yeah, I think the Guilfoyle has got the Jeannie Pirro playbook going, from what I could see. It was a little frightening. The thing that really strikes me is that it's the projection, which is so infamous with this individual who's currently in the White House. And the idea that of all of the really amazingly terrible things that are happening on his watch are somehow going to be manifest with a new president. And I hope that somewhere somebody puts together the reel of Charlottesville and George Floyd's death and coronavirus and bounties and all of the other things that we've heard about, which have indeed happened on this man's watch, and that it's not fair to say, oh, of course, the other side is gonna just even be worse. There's no evidence for that. But it's very disturbing to have to listen to that, in my opinion.
Yeah, if you go to the Lincoln Project and you look at what the Lincoln Project is putting out, you know, the Lincoln Project is a group of conservative Republicans who are opposed to what Trump represents. You know, they're not opposed to traditional Republican values. They're opposed to sort of the aberration of Republican values that Trump represents. And they are hitting point by point that you mentioned, Kevin. They're hitting with ads and with short video pieces every one of those issues. And I hope they have some resonance with other true conservatives in this country rather than the Trump conservatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think our cautionary tale is not against just Trump, but Trumpism. And
that's it.
Making sure that Trumpism does not dominate our democracy again. I mean, I just I wake up in the middle of the night in fear for our democracy, which is really on the line right now. And what I heard on the Republican convention, what little I heard, honestly, was lies, just plain lies. Bruce?
It's worth, if you have time, it's worth going back and rewatching the Leni Riefenstahl film, Triumph of the Will, which is a film about the Nuremberg sort of a rally of the Nazis. And it's just, I mean, point by point, you know, sort of image by image, you know, sort of lie by lie. It's exactly what you're seeing in the Republican convention. And, you know, it's an amazing documentary film. She was an amazing artist and photographer and filmmaker, although she also was a Nazi. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily, you know, political and artistic, you know, don't necessarily overlap. But it's frightening. It's truly frightening.
Would you repeat the name of that film, Bruce?
It's called Triumph of the Will. Leni Riefenstahl was the filmmaker. Very interesting woman, very interesting artistic career, but also a real enabler for Adolf Hitler and for the Nazis, particularly in the late 30s, when they were sort of emerging to power and taking over.
She was kind of a master propagandist, right, Kevin? Kevin?
Yeah, you know, I don't have that background on exactly who she was, but that seems to fit with the times. The comment that I was interested to make was that, we really see this amazing juxtaposition between the Biden story and the Trump story. And, I watched quite a bit of the Democratic National Convention, which we haven't talked about on this show. It was at much. But you can argue that it's, you know, butterflies and daisies and little girls in the field running around in the springtime. So it is aspirational. It is talking about how the democracy really does deserve to be protected. It talks about the fact that the display of the diversity of the country, which we did talk about last week, was really apparent. And I think the Republicans are going to attempt to show some diversity, but the messaging is clearly pretty dark, you know, pretty bleak about the fact that our country is heading towards a crisis, and only the person who's in charge now can save us from the crisis that we're in. It's just really weird.
Especially since he created a lot of it. Lynn?
That's right. I think the thing that I feel very concerned about and disgusted by, frankly, is this sort of pandering to find some people of color who will come up and stand and speak to the Republicans when really their entire platform has to do with maintaining white supremacy. You know, that to me, if you were to ask me to roll out what is the bottom line of the Trump campaign, it is that. It is, you know, controlling the narrative and trying to convince people that all can be as it was before. And it just feels to me like, you know, those times have come and gone, and we're in the middle of a watershed moment, which they don't want to address in any other way than law and order and crime and punishment. And, it's really kind of shocking to me how much dead eyes you see among those people who are testifying, you know, on behalf of Trump. Trump Jr.'s face looked like he could have been on a wanted poster. You know, this is not the party of joy and uplifting people. It is a party of grabbing their power and trying to keep control of some of the industry and some of the corporations that have fueled a lot of the past economic growth. Kevin.
You know, I was thinking today, given Lynn, what you're saying about, you know, the party of Trump and the news now that the convention isn't worrying about creating a platform for the next 4 years. Right.
I noticed.
And
that.
I was thinking about, you know, how does that work, and why did the folks in charge get on that path? I'm curious what people think, right? This is probably unique, Bruce. Maybe have we ever seen this before, where it's sort of like no platform, but here's the guy we're behind?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's that is unusual. in sort of American politics. You know, the platform, although it's a relatively minor part of most conventions, although at times it becomes very important, but most parts it's kind of a rubber stamp, you know, this is what we stand for. You know, to sort of just disregard that and just assume that, hey, we're the cult of personality is essentially what we're seeing here. That's fairly unusual in American politics. But what strikes me about watching the convention, the bits I have watched, is just how difficult a time they have of articulating what their purpose is, you know, other than to return Trump, and to celebrate, you know, with falsehoods, the accomplishments of the last 4 years, to downplay, you know, what is actually going on, and create, essentially trying to rewrite history, if you will. I mean, is what you see going on. And as a historian, that's disturbing to me, because, you know, it's always always sort of playing with truth, playing with interpretations that that undermine cultures and undermine societies. But let's not be surprised. I mean, what the Republicans are doing is going back to tried and true sort of campaign tactics that Nixon used in the 1970s and that Reagan used in the 1980s of creating this threat, and George Bush in the 1990s, George H.W. Bush, you know, of sort of, you know, America a threat by, you know, riots and disruptions and black people and, you know, all the threats, immigrants, you know, list goes on and on and on. But it's a tried and true playbook that has worked well for Republicans over the last 50 years.
I have a stupid question, Bruce. I am, like many of you, I'm sure, getting my email inbox filled with requests for money from one Democratic organization after another, one candidate after another. And I'm weary of that. I'm also broke. So when did campaigns, particularly presidential campaigns, become all about money, like more and more and more and more, to the point that it's out of sight?
Well, in my sense, they've always been about that. The problem is, not the problem, but the issue is it's largely been invisible to most people. I mean, basically, social media and the internet have made that very visible. And it was a success of Trump in 2016, and Obama really began to use social media in 2008, 2012, fairly effectively. And the Republicans saw that and sort of came back in spades with the help of the Russians and the help of the Ukrainians and the help of others in the social media field. But it's always been there. It's just not been as visible.
I think there's another issue, Bruce, to which, you know, you may know more about than I do, but I'm referring to the change in the processes of the Republican and the Democratic National Committee to rely on money as a factor, how much money people have been able to raise to be able to get on the stage. Mm-hmm. And this whole polling process has now been feeding into the way the Democratic, I'm more familiar with them, the Democratic National Committee, you know, are choosing and supporting their candidates. And it feels to me something like started in maybe 2016. And what bothers me about it is that not only are we getting requests for lots of, you know, money from a lot of people, but they all come in the guise of give us your opinion on this or that issue, which I would like to do, but then they make you donate for that opinion to be registered. And, you know, the whole thing has gotten out of hand, in my opinion.
Well, didn't you say, though, the whole debate business? I mean, the way the people were chosen for the debate stage was amount of money they raised and their polling, right? So those two issues. I think it somehow buries the message in my mind of what the people are trying to say. You know, I mean, it's overridden by that money and polling. Kevin?
In numbers, just the numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an intriguing set of criteria to make the debate stage. But the thought that comes to mind is that, well, the, you know, the kind of money that we're talking about is huge amounts of dollars. I mean, you know, millions of dollars. We're hearing about local races that were lost by progressive 2 years ago because the Republican campaign machine put, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars into local races in Washington to assure that the conservative kept their seat. But I think that's one side of the money spectrum. But the side, Truman, that you brought up, I think of as the other side of the money spectrum, is if somebody can't raise even a small amount of money relative to that huge scale, then do we really think they're competitive? Do you think they're a contender? It does clearly make money as a condition of entry to the club, in that sense. And maybe that's just fundamentally wrong. But I see this big spectrum of money in two different ways.
Well, yeah. And what you mentioned, Lynn, brings to mind, yes, we get those come-ons that say, we want your opinion, fill out this survey, and then submit and donate. It means that we as individuals are only able to influence government by buying our influence, which is appalling and leads me once again to get out the vote. But of course, that's being suppressed by Trump, by other folks in other states, by Republicans around the country. And that brings me to Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's appearance before the House of Representatives yesterday, which I did not see, but I've read about, and it sounds ridiculous. This guy wasn't even among the 53 potential choices that the post office board were considering. He was pushed in, basically, by the Trump administration. Any of you have comments about what can be done about that?
Well, not directly about that, but I will tell you that I did see on the news last night that Tacoma, it has a big processing center, post office processing center, and they had four of these big sorting machines, and they shut down two of them. And they had more than that. They shut down four of them. That's what it was. They had a bunch of those machines. They shut down four. And the union, I think, brought back one, and then management brought back the other. But so there's two have been brought back online since all of this started.
So what you're saying is postal employees are taking action against the Joyce. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, also, in fact, today is the day that the Postal Workers Union is hosting their big outcry. Last Saturday was a national set of protests hosted by Move On and other organizations. And in Washington State, the Indivisible Network is promoting people to go to their local post office and raise awareness of postal patrons about what is going on and who to contact and what to say. And on Vashon, we are creating some posters. We hope to have them out in the next couple of days. They will have a QR code on the poster, so you can just drive by, take a photograph of the QR code. It will lead you to talking points, who to call, what to say. And what I hope we can do across the country is raise expectations that this situation will be addressed. Because the Senate returns to work in just a couple of weeks, and we need to make sure that they hear loud and clear that people really want this problem fixed.
And Kevin, I saw saw a person with a poster, I think yesterday. They weren't on the actual post office property. Is that because they can't be legally? They were off the property.
I'm not sure where you saw them. We right out in front of the post office, of course, there's a sidewalk. And, you know, Vashon is famous for sandwich boards on sidewalk corners. So that's my expectation. But I'm not sure, true, where exactly you saw the person at.
Oh, they were across the street from the post office.
Our goal is to draw attention and make sure people have information without violating social distancing. Right. So we're trying to.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
make that happen.
Let's not be surprised, guys. I mean, the Postmaster General Office has always been a political appointee whose primary purpose has been to run the president's reelection campaign. I mean, you know, James Farley, Postmaster General under Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1930, he was a political operative. You know, I best love him because he's the Postmaster General who talked about, this is when the United States only had 48 states before Hawaii and Alaska had become states. So this is the 1930s. And he was the one who famously said, it's the United States of America, 47 states and the Soviet of Washington. So Washington has always been sort of a blue state, if you will, in contemporary sort of parlance. But, you know, also, let's not be surprised. Voter suppression has always been part of the American political system, whether it's been overt like poll taxes and literacy tests, or whether it's been less equally as overt, but less sort of direct. It's just having police officers standing at polling places and sort of scowling at people as they come in. You know, it's been a part of the American political system from the very beginning. We've made strides to try and overcome that, but let's not be surprised that, you know, the Republicans, when they're feeling threatened, will reach back into the playbook and try every mechanism they can to keep the vote and down and suppress the vote and to keep people who are not going to vote for the Republicans from voting.
You know, I've been concerned about the post office since, I think it was 1971. When it was made a kind of a quasi-governmental agency, kind of half private, half public. And I just thought that was going to put them in jeopardy alone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, you know, with the change in the mail moving online, you know, they are under threat as an institution, as an organization. But I just think that, I don't quite know how to deal with the structural element of it being part private, part governmental. You know, I'm not quite clear where the authority or the accountability lies. Does anybody know more about that?
Well, in part, the whole effort was part of that move towards what we call the Reagan Revolution. It was the beginning of that sort of privatization of American public services. So not surprising that it's gone the direction it's gone. The post office, even in this modern era, the post office is still a great deal. All you have to do is go online and order something and look at what it costs to ship by the post office versus UPS or FedEx or any of the other delivery services. The post office is sort of bounded by sort of rules and regulations, particularly the retirement requirements, that are just unrealistic. I mean, what's been set up is essentially, they've been set up to fail.
And
the purpose is to eliminate the post office as a public entity and move it into the private sector.
Yes.
Ever since the 1970s, that's been the goal.
And Bruce, do you remember when they imposed that retirement restriction?
I don't. It's been there for
long ago.
It's been there 30 or 40 years, I believe, but I'm not
positive. Oh, really? That long ago? Okay. But that's what's killing the post office at this point. If Congress could rescind that requirement, the post office could even turn a profit from what I've read.
Right.
And so who's fighting for that?
Well, Susan, this leads me to my next comment, which was in your beginning, this discussion on this topic, you asked who should we be, you know, protesting to, or, you know, who is it we even appeal to about the problems with this postal service? And I'm just going to suggest William Barr.
Really?
Good luck.
Yeah, we'll see what good luck does us.
Yeah, really.
The Attorney General would be quite amused with this on his breakfast plate.
Well, there is a call to contact the Washington Attorney General, who now has a lawsuit against this action by the administration, only because the summary of the lawsuit that I read, which was only a summary, said the charge was to stop further removal of or slowing down the Postal Service. So I think we need to ask Bob to also help restore the capacity, right, that's been removed. Mm-hmm. There's also the Board of Governors, and there's emails for the 6 Boards of Governors, I believe, that are available. So again, that QR code will allow you to get those emails. The other thing I wanted to mention, because we talked about the voter suppression thing, Bruce, that you brought up, and on our ballots coming up in November, we're going to have a choice to reelect Secretary of State Kim Wyman or current Representative Gail Tarleton as Secretary of State. And I had the good fortune to be on a town hall Zoom meeting with Gail some months ago and asked her, given how easy it is to vote in Washington State, right? Now we have postage paid, it comes to your door, you fill it out, you put it in the mail or go to a drop box. How can we possibly get the numbers up? What is the next thing to make voting easier in Washington? It couldn't be any easier, could it? And she said, well, it may be as easy as possible, but the problem we have is people have moved into this state from states where it is hard to vote. And what we don't have is an education program to reach out and connect with our Washington voters and tell them how easy it is to vote. And she says, you know, currently this is where she is frustrated with the current Secretary of State. She says, we don't see that happening. We have that opportunity to boost our numbers into the 70, 80 higher percentage. And so if we think that that's democracy in work, then I'll just mention that that's Gail Tarleton's platform. And to consider helping Washington improve our voting record by that kind of a candidate in the Secretary of State office.
Wow, that's interesting. I personally was gonna suggest that with our horse community here, we start a movement for renewing the Pony Express.
Oh. I thought you were going to say that we should deliver horse manure, but.
Wait, I couldn't hear both of you at once. What'd you say, Truman?
I just said I thought you were going to lead up to that we should be delivering horse manure to the right people.
Well, 2 for 1.
There you go.
You could do that.
Yeah. So, you know, I just read something that kind of made sense to me, I'm afraid to say. One of the things that we've encountered here on the island, speaking of the horse community, is having government entities compete with private industry. And we had that incident come up, it's been 30 years ago, I guess, or longer, where Paradise Ridge was becoming a major equestrian center. And we had a private company on the island that complained that the park district had to have competitive rates in order to not undercut his business. And I thought, you know, it's a reasonable argument. And that's the argument that folks are using to defund the post office, which, and I can't agree with, but I think that's interesting. Does it make sense to you what I'm saying?
Would you say it again? Yeah, it sounded like, I don't know what they were competing for.
Well,
who the private party was.
It's basically government should not compete directly with private industry and have rates or whatever that are not competitive. That's what the argument is. And that's what the argument for the post office is. We had that.
In other words,
go ahead.
Government should not be undercutting private business.
Yeah.
So the post office should not be less expensive than FedEx or UPS.
Yeah, that's.
But see, that's a specious argument to me, because that is not looking at the government's covenant with the people.
Exactly.
We are not business people working on contracts with money as the only bottom line in exchange for a service. We have covenants with people to uphold their needs, their interest, and it's a mechanism of, you know, rapid communication so the country can work as a whole.
Yeah.
So too bad.
And in fact, where it came from was originally Ben Franklin was using it to communicate with other revolutionaries, as it were. And that's where the application came from to say, hey, we need to have this service. And that's where it got started anyway. But I agree with you.
Kind of an interesting dynamic tension between creating economic opportunity and creating services to citizens. And maybe the values system is that if private industry can deliver services that are affordable, effective, reliable, and so on, right? Then yes, the government should encourage that to happen. But where private industry delivers services that are too expensive, unfair, not appropriately equally distributed across the population.
Or ecologically sound.
So in other words, not consistent with the values of the country, and the government has an opportunity to offer services that are more aligned with our values, then it maybe should step in to do so. But it clearly sounds to me, Truman, like there's a dynamic tension there, and you need to say, what are our values to allow us to decide which way to lean on that one?
So this gets us, you know, back to healthcare and everything else. And if you really think
about
it.
Education, everything.
Yeah, if you think about it, it does.
That's right.
And are we going to have, as you know, a series of things that the government's going to do for us that private industry could do, or you know, how's that going to work? So
we're talking about what's essential. What's essential to our value system? What do we as a country believe are essential services? Mm-hmm. So in other words, here on Vashon, does King County compete with anyone on Vashon who could build a road?
Exactly. That's it.
And do we rely on that, or do we need a government to use our tax dollars to provide essential services to us, like roads, like fire?
So,
like
back to the industry that I know, that the government does pay essential services for some communities for air service. They're like, for example, a Cordova. For years received a subsidy. The airline received a subsidy for providing essential air service to someplace that did not have enough business to support an airline going in there. So that's the sort of thing you're talking about. The government came in and supplemented the income for that private industry to provide an essential service. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's another example of which is an issue that came up 12 years or more ago on Vashon, is a public utility district.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the analysis that was provided looked at the costs, reliability, environmental cleanliness of a public utility district versus what we currently have as Puget Sound Energy. And it's very compelling in terms of the economics. You know, we would own the infrastructure as a public utility district, as opposed to right now, we rent from the utility on a long-term basis through paying for our electricity, right? We're essentially renting the infrastructure and buying the electricity. It does seem that the other thing I would go back to is that, you know, we the people own the country, right? So it really should be our decisions about to what extent we enable businesses to deliver services to us. And I would be probably much more inclined to go in that direction if we weren't seeing the huge economic disparity between CEOs and other people in the large businesses and the rest of the country, which is really has to be addressed. So no, I'm really not in favor of privatizing things when it just creates more multi-billionaires and leaves other people in destitute that we as taxpayers have to go in and provide security net for. So you know, we have to balance that out.
And you know, historically, I mean, that was a huge, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, but also throughout much of rural America in the 1920s and 30s, that struggle between public utilities and private utilities. I mean, you have Seattle City Light, you have Tacoma City Light, and then you have Puget Sound Energy. You have the Tennessee Valley Authority, you have the Columbia River Authority. I mean, there were lots of attempts in the 1920s and 30s to make sure that people had access to electricity, to roads, to, you know, all kinds of services, telephone, through public utilities, as well as through private utilities. And of course, what happened is essentially the private utilities won that battle because they had the money to put in the political campaigns. But significantly, you know, in Washington and Oregon, there's significant public utilities.
Well, and another example right now is in education, with the argument about charter schools versus mm-hmm. public schools, where that's money that everybody is paying in is now being appealed for by the charter schools. And, you know, I think to me in education, there's a lot of utility in some of the socialization and standardization, especially in the sciences, you know, so that there's a curriculum that set by some experts who agree these are the things not only that you need to know, but that will make you a well-rounded human being.
Well, and that the country needs. The country needs. The skills that the country needs to keep running. You know, that's they should have set those standards.
But what I'm saying, though, in the use of this example of charter schools is that all of a sudden, though, if those are prioritized and using taxpayer dollars, but there's no accountability and no standardization, I think we have gone down a very slippery slope
where
we're privatizing so that they can do what they want.
Yeah.
And that should be clear.
I agree. Well,
And I see the attempt to privatize schools as another move toward sustaining white supremacy, because it becomes education for the rich, primarily white people. And they then all get to keep their elite positions that dominate the nation. And, you know, I'm listening to us talk, and I hear us talk every week about all these things that need to be addressed, and that really the only way they're going to be addressed is if people take action. And our nation has gotten lazy about participating in democracy. And I think people are exhausted at being asked and or even taking action when they do. What do you guys feel about the notion in our next 3 minutes of encouraging people to participate in democracy, that's the only way those things we've taken for granted will actually continue to work? Any thoughts? Kevin?
We've been definitely encouraging folks to participate. Indivisible Vashon, as you well know, is what I'm part of. We have our monthly meeting tomorrow. At 7 o'clock, you can go to our indivisiblevashon.org website and find a way to sign up, find ways to take action. And it's both legislative action, it's electoral action, it's local, it's national. And so we are trying to move the needle in a way that we hope will make things better and address some of the inequities that we see.
What do you guys think will really put a fire under the butts of our citizens to actually take action? Lynn?
I don't know. You know, if there's one thing that's going to fire everybody up, I just wanted to say that in my readings, I've come across the two very different ideas of what freedom means and what liberty means. And they're two distinct things. Freedom is from a German word, and it basically is this inborn freedom that we all feel that we have and should have to develop according to our own natures. And liberty is a bunch of rights and laws and access to services that not everyone has always had. Liberty is often granted. And I think what I'm trying to say is that if we can't realize from the conflagration happening right now all around us that we are in some deep trouble, and we cannot just see this as a battle of our own individual wills, this is indeed for the future of the country and what we have left of democracy. And just I just say to people, please vote